EFT. Who knows, this could be the new jingle for WEFT.
I'll repeat that.
Who knows, this could be new jingle for WEFT.
Freestyle.
WEFT. 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 WEFT.
We prepared for it, yeah.
Research shows that mentors play a powerful role in providing young people with the tools to strive and thrive, to attend and engage in school, and to reduce risky behavior. Make a difference in your community by becoming a CU One-to-One mentor. Visit www.cuoneto1.org or call the Champaign or Urbana School District for more information.
This hour of programming is supported by the listeners of WEFT and by the Champaign Center Partnership, who foster a vibrant, inviting, and active core downtown, midtown, and campus town by strengthening businesses and building community. The CCP vision is to create healthy and vibrant micro-urban areas for residents and visitors through marketing, advocacy, and special events. CCP encourages and educates the public to shop locally throughout the year. Local businesses need your help more than ever. When you spend $100 at a locally owned business, $68 stays in your community. For more information about the Champaign Center Partnership, visit them on their website at champaigncenter.com or feel free to call 217-352-2400.
This is Dave Montgomery, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. We're going to look at a couple of things today. We've been looking at a series of what do you do with nonprofit agencies, and we don't always obey what we recommend, but we know what we should be doing. So we've been looking at a GoFundMe item, and I want to talk to you about that. But first of all, I want to talk about Doug Lynch. I'm not quite sure I've got his name right, but Doug Lynch just called me a little while ago. And it takes me back to the Kickapoo Trail, which now has a functional bicycle bridge across the Salt Fork of the Vermilion, the Middle Fork of the Vermilion. And Doug was involved. And he's just visited this morning the bridge. And he knew what I was doing and why I was doing it. And he wanted to congratulate me for doing that. It's kind of interesting because very few people know what I was doing. And this is part of where you're working with a nonprofit agency. You're often working with very few people, with people who have some imagination and some freedom to move. They're not stultified by their affiliations. And that's what I want to talk to you about. For about 10 years before there was a closing of the Conrail bed between Danville and Banham, I had been looking at that area. Dr. Kennedy and Shelford and Bestel, early ecologists, had studied the strip mines of Vermilion County. They were interesting to biologists because the pond was dated and you could see how the organisms changed in progress. Early on, there would be a few bloodworms and one particular species or two or three would occupy the pond and that be very numerous. After 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, the pond became more biodiverse with many different organisms and fewer of each. So one of our tasks in ecological classes was to go to these ponds with a drag line. Drag line is where you stand on a bridge and you drop a set of shovels that come together. When they drop, they spread. When you pull up, they close. You can do this in a fancy way with a crane and put the mullock out on the side and create a levee. This is how they created rivers, was to create a pond on which they put a pontoon. On the pontoon was a dragline crane, and you could throw that clam out and it would drop. It often had a weight with it, so it would drop easily into the land ahead. You would lift with the crane, the clam would close, and you would put that dirt onto the levee bank. When you dropped it onto the levee bank, you could either have a connection where you would release the material or it would release automatically. I think you had to have an attachment somehow to release the material. It just didn't drop easily when you dropped onto the levee. Well, we would take that mullock, and it was usually mullock because the strip mines have an overburden, and the overburden is often fairly acidic, and it has sulfur in it, and you would dig down in a mining shaft, and you would bring up the overburden and put it in what was referred to as a gob pile. Gob piles were often colored because of the oxidation of the iron material to minerals that were in it. They were also fairly scungy. They were the target of EPA, or Environmental Protection Agent, removing them into a safer place. So you can't see gob piles anymore, but you used to be able to drive along 150 and encounter a gob pile or two. So we would come up and we would dump into strainers where you would have different size strainers, if you were lucky, different pours, so that you would, first of all, take out the large chunk and then the smaller and smaller and smaller until you got to the colloidal clay. So you were making analysis of the pond. So if it was a recent pond, say a 10-year-old pond, you're going to get a different set of organisms, very simple. And if you were at the 75-year-old pond, it was going to be fairly rich and diverse. That's the sort of material you would take back to a lab, and you would apply certain tests on it. Some organisms were sensitive to light, for instance, so they would crawl away from a light situation. So you would identify those organisms that way. But there were, in a laboratory, you can set up artificial situations where you can, first of all, do an eye count, but then you can do a microscopic count, and then you can also apply chemicals, and you can get an idea of the colloidal nature of the clay that's there. We're in an area where there's sedimentary rocks, and they're covering coal seams that were compressed Carboniferous era growth that gives us our peat and our coal that we can burn. And it also burns with carbon burning. So we're concerned about it these days. In early days, coal was a way of warming your house, your industry, and coal was very important. It got from surface mining, where you put a shaft down, often at an angle, so pit pronies could take small wagons down to the mining face and load up and then come back and store that coal. Usually there was a railroad line nearby which could load that coal onto trains that would take it to elsewhere. But in Vermilion County, Illinois Power had a coal-burning furnace and produced electricity there. You boil water and create steam and drive that steam over fins that then make a rotor move, and that rotor moves a generator and produces electricity. You can't store it easily. You have to move it with grids across the country. So we have a bridge that's high in coal country. It's where the efficiency of underground mining was not as good as having strip mines. So the next attempt was to observe that the rivers took the river down almost to the coal face. So then you could move the overburden into the river and create a new site for the river and expose the coal. So in places in right near the Middle Fork River, you can see the rows where the river was moved and made coal available. The bridge is on more or less an east-west corridor from Urbana to Danville. It was a main line that went through to Indianapolis. The Indianapolis portion of it is still open. The peace between Danville and Urbana was not being used. So it was available to the Stigers Act to retire it. Prior to that, we had a lot of abandonments to small elevators that were about 5 miles apart, so a horse could drag grain into a small wooden elevator with a short siding. Those elevators and sidings were obsolete and have been replaced by supermarket elevators like the Cargill elevator, which is west of Champaign, or other similar elevators that sometimes were also in industries that produced alcohol from the digest of corn and soybeans to produce ethanol, which was added to fuel. And so we are utilizing the these elevators in a different way, and the lines are being abandoned. Well, knowing that corridor and knowing that we had already bought 33 miles of railroad bed in the Monticello area, and knowing that that innovation, along with other innovations where people were buying rail corridors for trails and for vegetation and for railing in some places, we were aware of the potential, but we were also aware that the federal government had been worried that they were losing too many railroad lines and that losing connectivity. And they also realized that if they wanted to come back with a main line from Urbana to Danville in years to come, they would face a lot of opposition from people who already owned the land and didn't want the railroad. And it would cost a small fortune to do that. So in their wisdom, they give money to rail trail developers to convert it into an interim trail. Knowing that, three of us belong to Heartland Pathways had to decide whether we could proselytize the community and have established organizations like the Vermilion County Conservation District or the Champaign County Forest Preserve or other agencies to gather up this line. The federal government is wise enough to not just give this bed to the locals. They ask the locals to buy the bed. The bed is not that expensive, but it is keeping the confidence of the federal government in the local community that wants to make a trail and to preserve the biology. We did a lot of attempts to remove or to get existing organizations together. We also had the opportunity of doing an authority. An authority is where you create a group of people. It might be nine people, but it gives you the opportunity to include the royal opposition that doesn't want a trail, for instance. They want more rows of corn and soybeans. It's rich soil there. If you take out the ballast, the corn and soybeans will grow on virgin soil. And if you have a situation like that, the corn that grows on either side is about 12 inches shorter than what grows on the virgin soil. So there's money in under that railroad bed. But you have to have an what the authority does is let people know what they're doing. So people come together and they can think about the value of the corridor. For instance, farmers often are aware that they would like to have something like a perennial soybean, so they didn't have to dig it each year and create erosion and send soil and chemicals down the Mississippi to the Gulf and create a hypoxia or a dead zone. They take years for farmers to come around to that thinking because they're survivalists. They've come here perhaps as peasants, perhaps as entrepreneurs, and they're determined to get every inch out of the soil, this very rich soil that came as glacial till from the Laurentian seal in Canada, on the backsaw or inside or underneath glaciers, continental glaciers that came south. We have them here. We have the Yankee Ridge Moraine, the Champagne Moraine, the Cerro Gordo Moraine, the Bloomington Moraine. When the world warmed, then refugia, little places where the glaciers didn't meet, preserved the vegetation that may have been here before there was a cold climate and glaciation. There is also to the south, and some of these organisms came in as from the east, New England aster, for instance, from the south, cordgrass perhaps, from the west. You don't have June grass here, but that was a grass. Some of the dry area grasses came in from the west. So we were watching this corridor for the best part of 10 years. And when the occasion arose that Conrail closed out, we approached Conrail. And yes, they would be willing to sell the land for interim trail use. And that was okay with the Federal Transportation Board. And it was okay with us. We had voted to go to the Surface Transportation Board, and one that didn't think that this was an interesting thing to do. It was going to be more work for more people. So we had approved of it. Now we have to figure out who might be interested. Well, one group, after we had done the hack work of getting a docket from the Surface Transportation Board, the Champaign County Design and Conservation Foundation, formed some 20 years before, because Champaign is kind of flat and it needed some caretakers, some advocates for forest and prairie and park districts. And so two or three people got together and created the CCDC, the Champaign County Design and Conservation Organization. And so they wanted to belong to our docket. We were agreement to do that. But it was after the fact. They didn't take the initiative to make the first move and to do the hack work and to know that the ponds of the Kickapoo State Park were there, and an interesting place for a destiny for a train. that would for a bicycle way that would leave Urbana and go 25 miles to Danville. We started to buy the bed. We realized that there were warranty deeds and easements and adverse possessions, different ways of looking at putting in a railroad. So the deeds associated with the Conrail included these, but the Rail Banking Act quieted all those deeds. You didn't have to worry about an easement which allowed the land to go back to the adjacent farmer, or adverse possession, which meant that the railroad went over a small portion of farmland and didn't bother telling anyone, and that would go back to the farmer. The warranty deeds were very definitely owned by the railroad, so they didn't necessarily go back to the adjacent landowner. Some groups, farming groups, rural groups, felt like they owned the land in entirety, and they had proselytized their people to not make any move to take back a railroad bed. And that didn't always work, because sometimes a trail group moved in and bought the line when the farmers were sitting waiting for the railroads to give them the land and not worry about charging them property values. So we, on the Conrail bed, we had a protection from those deeds, and money from the corridor. There would have to be an assessment of what would be the cost of putting in a bridge, for instance. That's out of the $12 million provided for the 25 miles, $3 million was assigned to the bridge that was 100 feet off the ground and a quarter of a mile long, a very large bridge. And if you fall off it, you die. Well, we had to look after that area. CCDC, in genuine effort, did not get the money to buy the railroad bed. So immediately the federal government allows the railroad interim trail use people to have first go at it. Then other railroads can take in. So CSX bought the line, and it sat quietly there. CSX is a huge railroad complex, mostly in the east, and their watching was to look at the railroad connectivity in the Danville area especially. And although the rail had been pulled on this by this time, they still had the potential. So the rails were removed by demolition companies. The last train out started in Urbana on Norfolk Southern. And it is now, it used to be Conrail Yards in Urbana. And it leaves 1 mile for to be associated with the railroad yards. And then they take out the spikes and undo the stick rail. And they have an engine with some dummy cars. And then about a quarter of a mile of railroad flatbeds, and they have a winch, and they winch up the rail and winch it onto this corridor, and that means you're left with ties and plates, and the spikes have already been taken out. You have vehicles that run on the rails, and those vehicles I've spoken about last time are automated now, but the attempt was to remove the spikes. And so you had some aid to do that, but it was a lot of work. And those spikes have been in for perhaps since the 1850s. So they are bent and rusted, and they usually get replaced. They leave a hole, but that we'll talk about in a moment. The crane lifts the rail up, and then the stick rail is still joined together, and that quarter mile is wound onto the flatbed train. It isn't rounded, it isn't taken right to the cab, because when you have rows and rows of these pieces of steel, if the train has to stop quickly, then that would move right through the cab. So there is usually a bunch of dummy cars that would prevent that from happening. But that train loads up with perhaps 16 or 20 rows of rail, the left side and the right side. And they're usually taken to an industry in the east, in this case, to New York, where the joiners are removed and the bolts that are involved with the joiners are removed. And if the rail is of quality, it is welded into welded rail, and that welded rail comes back to replace a stick rail that is worn out. You have to know your onions as to whether this particular closing was quad quality rail, and it was. So it was loaded up quarter mile at a time. So the last engine out took the rail. It's like a little bit of like a caterpillar, except that the rail didn't go around and move along again. It's slow process, and lots of people involved, because you also have to pick up the plates afterwards, and you have to pick up the leftover spikes, and you have to lift up the railroad ties. The railroad ties are adjudicated. Some of them are very good and fairly recent. So they are kept. Some of them are curly. Early railroad ties were hewn with a broad axe, and they were hewn according to the grain of the tree. And that was very helpful in a way, because if you hew a piece of wood like a railroad tie, according to its grain, it's much more protected from the weather. It's unfortunate that when you go to salvage them, they are very hard to stack. If you're going to stack 9 by 9 sets of ties and sell them at Menards for landscaping, or you're going to take them for re-rail, the curly ties go to landscaping rather than to re-rail. So the ties are spotted with paint, and you know which ones are going to be thrown out and which ones are picked up. They're picked up by a truck which is called a knuckle boom. It has a crane on the back, and the driver of the vehicle. Well, sometimes it's two drivers. There's a driver that's driving the truck forward and back, and the person who operates the crane, and that person picks up ties. First of all, there's been usually a bulldozer with angles on it that moves the ties to the side, and the truck can move through. So you have to know that that you're hoping there's no spikes left, because a good truck with a heavy tire can cost you a lot of money. So when you move those ties and the rails to the side, then cranes can pick the rails up and put them on semi-trailers. In this case, it wasn't on the semi-trailers. It was on to the train itself. So different ways of demolishing a railroad. Meantime, we were watching. We were caretakers, self-appointed air caretakers, because the CCDC was interested in working with park districts and forest reserves and the like to acquire the line, and they were bold enough to do the fundraising, and they were even bold enough to want to take over. So at one stage, even though we had initiated the docket, then we went to the CCDC lawyer at one stage, and we were told we were no longer involved and that we were a conflict of interest. So as you look at your nonprofit agency, it's not always straightforward. There are these things. So you have to swallow and say, well, if that's how you do it, let's do it, as long as you do it. But they didn't do it. So that was too bad. CSX bought the line, and it sat there while CSX decided what it wanted to do with this conglomeration of railroad bids. But I think it's probably the state got involved. They have a bicycle way division. The Department of Natural Resources has such a division, and people who know about rail trail involvement and the national rail to trail conservation movement was growing. So 20 years later, there was a move to move and shake this trail. Little risky, because not everyone wants a trail. They want more corn and soybeans. The problem then is that the railroad, CSX, owns the line, and they'd have to be convinced that if they were let it, the bed to be an interim trail use, it was indeed interim trail use, and they could come back with a railroad line if they wanted to. So eventually CSX quiesced and allowed the rail bed to be an interim trail use. And that got to then have not only federal Rail Banking Act money, but state money from Department of Transportation, which is responsible for transportation, and bicycles are a form of transportation, believe it or not. And then the Department of Natural Resources, which has a division for bicycles, and also is in control of vegetation on either side. And then there are the locals, the park districts, the forest preserves. And there's some debate about whether the park district in Urbana could own some of this line. And not really so, because this was way outside their jurisdiction. So it went to the forest preserve. And you have to know that the Forest Reserve has some limitations. George Fell, who put together the Nature Conservancy, went to the University of Illinois under... So we were caretaking. There's people who want to move onto the right-of-way and park their vehicles there, park their industry there, dig up certain elements of it as they assume they own it. And so that means you have to have attorneys to point out that this is an interim trail use agreement and it's one more public use, and that is allowing it to be still used. So the warranty deeds and the easements and the adverse possessions were not discussable. So, but some people even so would invade the bed. I spent a lot of time running back and forth along that 25 miles, getting to know people and getting to explain them to them the potential of this corridor. One little portion of it took a duck, took a dive to go through over the Salt Fork River at a node. So the road, which would usually go straight, and the railroad you would think would go straight, didn't so happen. The old road and the railroad line went through as a node. So on that particular corridor, about half a mile long, there's original prairie that hasn't been herbicided or mown for a long time. The bridge itself was a problem for people. I want to now say something about the people who are adjacent to the Vermilion County end of the line. The Vermilion County Conservation District was designated as the owners. They're not very financial, but they do a lot of conservation work along with strip mines and other places and lots of railroads. So they're essential. They're a little bit advanced in terms of biology than the forest preserves, because the forest preserves have a real recognition of recreation. And when George Fell created the Nature Conservancy, probably with a background in East Urbana, where there was good prairie, came back after having formed the Nature Conservancy to form a forest preserve and later a conservation district. The forest preserve is a little more oriented to recreation. So that supervision included the bridge. So there's Bucktown. And Bucktown is a little town on the east side of Oakwood. And it's an area where people salvage, where it's relatively low income, perhaps early miners. But I got to know people. And one of those people had a motorcycle, and we climbed on the back of it, and we'd ride across the bridge. If you go at 50 mile an hour across a bridge like that, there's no problem. You don't fall into the gap between each tie. So some of my first experiences with Doug Lynch were on his bicycle. And at this time, you have to know the ties are gone, the plates are gone, the spikes are gone, and the rails are gone. But the rails were keeping the bridge together some. When they took the rails out, the bridge with a crane and bulldozers and the semi-trailers, this wobbled a little bit. I guess it was the train that actually took out the last pieces, but it was unstable. So they have extra on along the side to stabilize the bridge. The bridge is basically the main corridors are I-beams, big I-beams. And the difficulty is that it's 100 feet off the ground. And those people who rode a motorcycle across it were doing so without realizing what it was like to walk. So if we got them off their motorcycle to walk across the bridge, there was a different cat. They would have to get down on their backside and be very frightened of the height. So there were also little jutouts where if a train were coming and you were caught on the bridge, you could climb onto a jutout. Doug Lynch saw that I was taking out this extra row of steel in order to put in a tie between a tie so that people wouldn't freak out. But CCDC, the group that had decided that they would like to take charge of this corridor, decided that I was untoward doing that because I was getting out there where it was high. And if I fell off the bridge, well, I was likely to die. It didn't worry me that much. I used to drive my car across it. I would have volunteers helping. We were putting wooden spikes, plugs into every spike hole. So each tie has two spikes, and thousands of spikes. There were 998 ties on that bridge. And we put plugs in every one because the bridge ties were huge. They were 10 feet long as distinct from a regular tie, which is more like 8 feet long and much bigger. They've been removed now and they put, they're done differently. But I've, in a process, what the pugs do is save the water from getting into the spike holes and rotting the tie. So somebody now has those ties, and I'm sure they're in a bridge somewhere because only a few of them would be dead. They were very good ties, and the rumor has it that those ties were not from Illinois. There were no trees big enough for those ties. So not replaceable. We brought in ties from the demolished railroad bed and had piles of ties that we put into the gap between the ties. So now Doug Lynch creates a wrench for me. He works with metal, and he saw that I had difficulty undoing the bolts that held the steel down. And so he has called me because this morning he is standing on the bridge itself, and he wanted to congratulate me for doing what we did many years ago. This was like, you're thinking not 20 years ago, but 30 years ago. And there had to be some perception to do that. And that's what I want to encourage you to do, to have that dream, to, for instance, go to the Monticello area and look at us 33 miles of railroad bed and talk to people. You can't do regional planning easily, but you can talk to people, and that's a modest form of regional planning. And you talk to the cities, and you talk to the counties, you talk to the villages, and gradually there gets to be the concept that this might be a good idea, and you might have a good idea like that. And we've come almost to the time when I should remind you that we did that surveillance for years, didn't get any very much kickback for when the trail went in. This was sort of our volunteer contribution, but it was fairly enormous. And now comes the new corridor, and the bridge has had all those ties, bridge ties, removed and down to the steel. And I haven't been over there to check, but I assume that it's like other places. They prefabricate a trail and weld it to the underpinning, and the trail would have a cage on either side, so you can't do things like commit suicide off this 100-foot high bridge. And it's been completed, and Doug is very pleased. He no longer lives at Bucktown or nearby the bridge. He's a little area called Possum Trot, but the Department of Natural Resources has opened up the road next door to the end of the trail so that the people who run the trail can go into the Kickapoo State Park. And this is a rather wonderful experience. And it's nice to get a little feedback from many, many years ago. Doug is still, he's up near Kennicott and in a different location, but he's a nature lover, and he was very helpful in getting me underway to try and preserve this bridge. And just doing that work is enough to allow people to wonder what this crazy is doing out on the bridge, and it gives them a chance to ask questions and to realize that you're dreaming of a trail that might be useful in the future. Don't be surprised that sort of recognition might not be forthcoming, because when people get to be in charge of a trail, like forest preserves and conservation districts, they need to raise the money to do what they need to do. And we actually encourage them to do that. It takes a little bit of guts to do that, because we end up not being compensated for the cost of our volunteer involvement. And so now we have a GoFundMe, and that's the next step in this whole business, is to try and figure out how to raise money to do things like the Kickapoo Trail, or to do things like the 10 miles from Rantoul to Paxton. And we have a link, and we have the help of two people in Santa Fe who have their roots in Champaign and have roots in Southern Illinois, and know well what the railbed is, the Kickapoo railbed is like, and what we do and how we imagine. And so we putting that GoFundMe up, and now you have to figure out who gets the image. This is only going to go to people who have computer skills. This is not necessarily going to, the link is not going to go to people who don't have computers, or have computers but only work with them for email, or have small computers that they can text with but don't have a picture situation where they can go to a web page and get information like a link or a blog. We also have a blog, and the blog deals with the request we have of the Department of Transportation to use some of this projected infrastructure money to create a prairie trail on an old retired Route 45 between Rantoul and Paxton. And we're going to be in competition with all the problems that have occurred in the South with tornadoes and water and what have you. But this is legitimate. If this corridor helps to preserve some remnant prairies, and we talk about that. You have to decide what you're going to talk about. What is going to be your target? Well, the target to start with for Heartland Pathways is 100,000. But if you're looking at the development of 33 miles for a trail and preservation of the prairie on either side, you're going to have to think about multi-million dollars. You're gonna, if you wanted to rerail a portion of it so railroad museum trains can get into Champaign, you're going to have to think about multi-million dollars. If you're going to go down to Shady Rest and Hole, the South Harbor, and let people visit the Sangamon and have a niche experience that many people haven't even ridden a train, let alone go down to the Sangamon and go fishing in the Sangamon or meet with friends and relatives or discover the wonderful understory herbs that are there. And this portion of it is flatland, bottomland vegetation, and then it's upland on the Cerro Gordo Moraine. And there's questions like, can you walk down the line that we would put in as a railroad line? If we put in 1 mile of railroad line, it's going to take at least $3 million. And so you have to think 100 years of hence, and you do a little at a time. And I'm getting to the end of my time. So I want you to dream of your own GoFundMe and think of how you're going to raise money. And WEF does it very well. And they have to provide snail mail for people who don't have computers and for people who only use a certain portion of the computer. Like they don't usually rely on blogs and links and other aspects of passbooks or apps or those sorts of things. So we'll be back to talk more about this. And thank you for listening. And if you have a Facebook, you might just go to Facebook and see what we're talking about. This has been Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. And WEFT in the background and Banner Public Television in the background, because they let us do things that we couldn't do otherwise. Okay, bye.
And to check out more information about WEFT, go to weft.org. Look for the About tab, and you can find a whole bunch of information about WEFT. You can find our mission statement. You can find our history, including a video from the 90s. You can find out about our governance. You can find how to propose a show. You can see pictures from our archives. And you can even check out recent episodes of WEF Sessions. And there's a whole lot more. And that's just under the About tab on weft.org. So I encourage you to go to weft.org and find out about community radio, what's going on, what's happened, and how you can support community radio. That's weft.org.
The WEFT Music Archives are back. You can listen on demand. Thanks to our partners at Spinatron, many of our music shows are once again available, archived on our website. Go to our Spinatron calendar page at weft.org and click on any of the green colored shows. You'll be able to start an in-browser player and listen to that show whenever you want. Look for the in-browser player, click on the little triangle to start playback. Now, because of copyright restrictions, the music shows can only remain online for 2 weeks. So if you caught part of a show and you want to hear it all, get back to WEFT within 2 weeks after the show first aired, and you can check out our amazing locally produced, homegrown grassroots music on your schedule, conveniently, whenever you need to. weft.org, just click on the Spinatron calendar page. I think that is labeled recent spins on the WEFT home page.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500.